What's been in my mind since, I think, Saturday, Friday, Thursday, is the issue of the degree to which one's Buddhist practice or one's spiritual practice is for oneself and the degree to which it's for other people, the degree to which it's oriented towards oneself and oriented towards other people. And I was teaching this retreat at Tassajara, and a young man spoke very eloquently about his sense, his understanding that being of service to other people in compassionate work was really kind of the central focus, should be a central focus of spiritual practice, and that and not really focused on oneself, and that in being of service and help and to others, that was also transformative for the person doing the service. And he wanted to kind of understand that as being really, for him, the clearest statement of spiritual life. Was that more or less accurate? Remember those who were there? So it's been on my mind since he spoke that. And there's many different opinions about this topic, and I suppose I'll offer you my opinion today. Though my opinion, I think, will be kind of an attempt to include all opinions within it, have a place for it all. I've noticed over the years, since my earliest involvement with Buddhism, when I told people I was doing Buddhist practice, how often people would ask me, what good is that for others? And I've also heard from many people who are engaged in Buddhist meditation practice that their family or friends would sometimes protest their involvement with meditation practice because they thought it was selfish. You know, you're sitting there, you're closing your eyes, it's self-absorbing, it's narcissistic. And really, what good is it to other people? How is it helping other people? And sometimes people have been at loss in how to respond, and felt very uncomfortable because certainly on the surface it's self-focused, the practice, and then we sit down and close our eyes. There is in America a very strong legacy of a kind of a social gospel that comes from the 19th century. Where religions, American religions in the 19th century, some of the mainstream ones, started feeling very strongly that one of their main missions was to be involved in social outreach, social causes, soup kitchens and hospitals and all kinds of things. And so much so that that the notion of what it is to be a religious person was very much tied up with being of service to the world around them. And to place this in a little bit of a context, in my growing up in Europe, which I grew up somewhat in Norway and Italy and places like that, my memory of it is that that's that sense that the religion and religious people, spiritual kind of your church, are supposed to be kind of actively and fully involved in social work and in society at large. I never got a sense that that was a strong value. That was kind of responsibility of religion to be involved in that way. I mean, it wasn't that the religious people were immune to it, but I didn't feel like it was a strong social gospel that I feel here in the United States. And in places like Norway, people focus a lot on what the government should do, and the government is a socialist government, and the government is very much involved in providing lots of services to the citizens there. And the expectation, I think, to some degree, that people... other people there is to expect the government to do that. I remember when I was a young hippie, and I was very interested in living in communes and kind of dropping out of society and growing all our own food and being self-sufficient. I'd lived in some communes here in America, and then I went back to Norway, and I was interested in doing the same there. And I went to, and I'd found some to live on, spend some time on. And I would explain to them my ideology of self-sufficiency, which isn't, America has a plurality of ideologies it's, struggling with. And there's a social gospel ideology, but there's also that of being self-sufficient. And part of the hippie movement was belonged to that. And it was very funny to be up in Oregon, in the woods of Oregon, and to find that the John Birchers and the hippies had something in common up there. In this thing of being self-reliant and getting the government off their backs. And so I went back to Norway, and I would explain to people my views on self-sufficiency and living alternative lifestyles and growing your own food and all that. And the Norwegian hippies who were living on farms and living in communes were horrified by this idea, because they felt that that everybody had a responsibility to contribute to society, and that this was abrogating that responsibility. So what I found in Norway, for example, is that many people felt a sense of social responsibility. A lot of it was some people did things on their own to help out with others, and some people and there was also the government was very much involved, and people channeled some of their dedication through the government. But there wasn't a sense that the religious traditions were supposed to be so actively involved as you find here in America. That's not to say that the American way, social gospel, has anything wrong with it. It's just interesting to put it in its context and to understand how maybe it arises out of causes and conditions. It's a culturally conditioned phenomena. So when Buddhism has come to the West, it encounters this social gospel understanding that religion is supposed to be contributing to society and actively involved. And sure enough, a lot of American Buddhists then, because they grew up in Western culture, have actively been involved in trying to channel their Buddhist interests and Buddhist practice along those lines. It's far from the idea that in Asia, Buddhists are not involved in social involvement. But there's some paradoxes with that. I mean, you find a wide range. You find some Buddhists who will absolutely refuse, like Buddhist monks in Southeast Asia, who absolutely refuse to be involved in social outreach and anything except teaching the Dharma. And you find some who are actively involved in hospitals and schools and involved in the community and environmental issues. And you find a wide range, even in the same tradition of Buddhism in Asia. So it isn't that one particular tradition has it or doesn't have it. It often has to do with how individual practitioners interpret it there. But there are some paradoxes to be seen. One of the great divides, perceived divides, in Buddhism is that between Mahayana and so-called Hinayana, which is, Hinayana is a derogatory term for, nowadays, for the only living representatives of that tradition is the Theravadan Buddhists. Hinayana literally means the crummy vehicle, the crummy folks. And so the Theravadins aren't so happy about receiving this title from the Mahayana, who are famous for their compassion for others. But one of the paradoxes along this line is that the arhat ideal, the ideal of Theravadin Buddhists, is to become an arhat. That's the primary spiritual path that's being offered. And the Mahayana primary path being offered is that of the Bodhisattva. And the image, the stereotypic, almost cartoon-like image, character image of these two traditions, is that the Bodhisattva is a person dedicated to the welfare of others, and their whole practice is other-oriented. Whereas the arhat is self-absorbed. It's all about their own practice and their own attainment of liberation. But then when I went to Asia, I knew about this character, but I was struck by another character, maybe balancing that one. I saw many times in Japan, the Zen monasteries where I lived there, in the temples, that these are people who are Mahayanists, who had taken Bodhisattva vows, and they would spend much of their life, much of their practice, cloistered in their monasteries or in their temples, involved in practice. Certainly, many years of training that a young monk would make before they go become a temple priest in Japan, it was very cloistered, very little, almost no involvement at all in society around them. I mean, when I was there and I was in the monastery and was getting malnourished because there was no protein. I had to, when no one was watching, jump over the wall to go into town to get milk, powdered milk, because I wasn't allowed to leave. And then I went to Southeast Asia, to Thailand, and I was surprised to see how many of the temples and monasteries in Thailand were actively involved in their local communities. There was the first temple I went to, they opened the temple doors for, certainly for orphans, but also for poor young, mostly men, but young men and women from the countryside who wanted to come to Bangkok to get a better education, didn't have the money for it. They could come and live in the monastery for free. And I don't think that anything was expected of them. And they were also fed out of the monastery supplies. And I saw lots of examples of monks in Southeast Asia who were involved in various kind of social projects. And so the paradox, on one hand, the ideology, what I heard, was one was selfish and the other was not. And in practice, what I saw in these two dramatic examples was the opposite. It's very simplistic to paint it in both scenarios are very simplistic and not accurate. But often people will interpret these traditions simplistically from first impressions. I remember I studied for a couple of years with Robert Aiken Roshi in Hawaii. He was a Zen teacher who is probably the dean of engaged Buddhism in America, at least among the circle of Buddhists that we're kind of more widely connected to. And he has written books on engaged Buddhism. He wrote one of the first ones. And he was very actively involved himself in various engaged forms of practice all over the world. And he was one of the founders of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And very important person for infusing American Buddhism, Zen and Vipassana and all that, with a sense of social responsibility and engagement. And he was a very radical liberal, and he refused to pay taxes. He paid his taxes. He put it in escrow someplace. Is that the right word? And he told the government, I'm not keeping this money, but you're not getting it either until you can promise that my taxes won't go for military purposes. So when you tell me that I'll release it from escrow, whatever, wherever it's kept. And so I was practicing with him, with his community, and there was a tension in his community. There were some people who moved to Hawaii because of his social engagement. They wanted their Buddhism to be connected to social involvement. And they were very much involved in various ways, and they came there to be under his tutelage and his inspiration. And there were other members of the community who had absolutely no interest in active social involvement and social causes and politics and whatever. And the tension in the community was that the people who felt that others should be involved in social action were at odds, in a sense. There was a tension between those people and the people who had no interest in that, but who were very serious about doing their spiritual practice. The people involved in social action felt it's not really Buddhism unless it involves social action, also outreach also. And the people who are not inclined to that view felt belittled or felt like maybe they didn't have a place there or felt, inadequate, or just, there was a tension there in the community. I think Robert Aiken, I don't believe he actively contributed to that tension. I felt he was always very accommodating to both camps. But I certainly felt the tension within the community. So there are two extremes. If you take the extreme views of those people who feel Buddhist practice should be 100% involved in social action, and so people go off and live that life, go become a chaplain in a hospital or do hospice work or do political work someplace, go off to someplace else in the world and do work. And it's really beautiful. It's really inspiring to see those people do those things. And the other people who focus primarily on their own practice and will not spend much time at all in social involvement and action, and but spend years and years intensive meditation practice. Certainly not doing social action, but maybe not even hardly talking to their family. I spent 8 months in a monastery in Southeast Asia, where I didn't talk to anyone really for 8 months. It was basically a silent retreat, except for talking to the teacher. And during those 8 months, I only called my mother at Christmas. And other people have been much longer, not even involved in the basic social relationships that we all some would expect are important. And other people do years and years that way. So there's those two extremes. Are there ways of reconciling these? Are they always going to be opposed? Is one of them right and the other wrong? There's a very strong tendency among people to have a view about which, where in the spectrum is right, often based on where they see themselves fitting on that spectrum. And then assuming this is the right way, this is the only way, and being very critical of people doing the other. In the Theravada tradition, there is a little teaching analogy for the value of practicing for oneself intensely. And that is, if everyone is kind of can't swim, I suppose, and is kind of out at sea, kind of drowning, and everyone's in that condition, no one's going to get out. But if one person has managed to swim onto shore, and then that person can reach down to the water and pull other people out. And that's the example given for people involved in kind of intense practice on their own. It's not meant to be selfish, but how can anybody help others if they haven't reached the dry, safe shore? And only when other people have really seen the possibility of freedom and attain some level of freedom and liberation can they really be of help to other people along those lines. And so it might take years and years of practice. The example in the teachings of the Buddha, as far as I could read, and I could be wrong about this, there's never any indication that the Buddha practiced his practice or encouraged people to practice Buddhist practice for compassionate reasons, because their practice was going to help others. The expectation, however, in the presentation is, once someone is liberated, that they will be compassionate and involved in helping others. So it's a little bit, it'd be nice, it'd be very satisfying for us to hear that their motivation for practice is compassion. But we don't have that indication. But once you're liberated, compassion is a strong motivating force. The people who kind of are on the engaged Buddhist side, so for some reason, are not satisfied with that kind of approach and don't want to leave other people behind, don't want to kind of feel that there's so much suffering in the world, and it seems, some of them say it seems selfish to be involved in their own well-being, engaged in their own freedom, if other people are left behind. And so rather than getting up on the dry shore, they're going to trash around in the water also, and just push people up the best they can. I don't know if that was a fair way of putting it, but there's various points of view, and one of the more inspiring ones for me is the ones that there's a few. One is that the very involvement with social action is itself a practice for oneself. That we don't have to separate these two out so much. So, so you find that involved in service, that you, if you do mindfulness and practice mindfulness carefully and reflect on your motivations and your the challenges you have in those kinds of roles, it'll be self-purifying and self-liberating if you do it well. I don't feel like American Buddhism has come up with a very clear, theology or philosophy or rationale explaining how this works. And a lot of people have that view, and I think it still needs to be developed. I see it as an experiment that many people are committed to. The other thing that inspires me about kind of social engagement sense of being a service, help to others, is that even before a person is maybe enlightened, fully enlightened, the sensitivity that comes with mindfulness practice lends itself to being very sensitive to the condition of other people around us and the world around us. And I think often there's kind of a natural motivation that arises out of that motivation to meet that suffering in the world. In my own practice, at some point in my practice, in the early years, and sometimes it was very self-focused, I knew that I was suffering and I wanted to somehow find a way not to suffer so much. At some point, it made no sense for me to continue doing my practice if it was just for myself. There wasn't the motivation there or the rationale for doing it. And the only thing that kept it going or what inspired it further was a sense that I was doing it for other people also. And it wasn't that I turned then to social work or engaged work, but the motivation for my own practice was somehow to be of service to other people. And I had some examples at the time of some of the people who kind of inspired me or kind of pointed towards the possibility of freedom the most were people sometimes who were when they were inspiring me, were not involved in social action in any kind of way. I remember one person who was completely, in my eyes at least, at peace with what he was doing at that time. And he wasn't even aware that I was watching him. But I felt this phenomenal sense that this man was settled, contented, at peace with himself without any conflict in the world. Involved just this one activity of what he was doing at that time. I mean, it was over. He was doing it for over a long period of time, but this one job that he had. And whenever I saw him, I was very inspired by that possibility of freedom and liberation and peace that I felt coming from him, the simplicity of way of being. And that was very, very important for me, his example. My first teacher in Thailand, he was important for me in many ways, and he certainly was an example of someone who's reaching out to help others. He was helping me every day. I went to interviews, and he seemed to be tried very hard to make support my practice. But one of the more powerful kind of experiences I had with him was I was practicing in a little hut on the edge of the monastery, and there was a schedule I was supposed to follow, and the expectation was I was supposed to be meditating day and night, you know, all the time, and not doing anything else. And one day, I don't remember why, but for some reason I wasn't meditating. I was kind of walking around the monastery. And who did I bump into? It was the teacher, the abbot. I thought, oh my God, you know, busted. he saw me. He was maybe 30, 40 feet away. He certainly saw me. But there was a way that he saw me, that he looked at me, that I don't know if I can in any way convey to you how I perceived it. But it was something like he saw. I felt like I'd never been seen by someone in the same powerful way. I felt like I was completely seen by this person. At the same time, I felt like he was seeing not right through me in the sense of understanding everything about me, but seeing right through me like I was just part of the scenery. I was just part of the trees. Like I was no different than the trees growing next to me where I was standing or walking. That I had just as much. I was just part of nature and fully present nature. There was no. He had no judgments, no aversion, no criticism, no praise for me. He saw me kind of in what in Mahayana Buddhism is sometimes called the thusness or the suchness. I was just there, and he was not seeing me through the interpretations of. I was a meditator. I needed to be accomplishing something. I needed to be a certain way. I needed to be following a schedule. He didn't see me along any conventional lines like that. But I felt very seen in a way that was beyond conventions. And that was very, very helpful for me, was that being seen by him, those few moments. And I don't think there was any idea that he was trying to help me or whatever. At the time, he was just walking through the monastery. I have no idea whether I was projecting all that. But I don't know if it matters, because it certainly helped me. It gave me a possibility how to do this for myself. There is a famous discourse by the Buddha where he tells a story of two acrobats that he encountered. And the acrobat, there's an apprentice and the acrobat. And the acrobat says to the apprentice, okay, climb up on my stick. He's going to hold a stick on his forehead or something, and or his chin or something, and balance. And the acrobat, the apprentice is going to climb up on the stick, high up in the air, and balance on the stick, and they're going to do tricks up there. So the apprentice, so the acrobat says to the apprentice, so you climb up the stick there, and we'll make a good living this way, through people, you know, making donations, like they do on this kind of street performers. And the acrobat said, so you climb up the stick, and we'll make a good living. And while you're up there, you guard over me, and I'll guard over you. You know, I'll make sure that you don't fall. I'll watch you, and you make sure that I'm okay down here. And the apprentice says, no, that's not the way we should do it. Rather, I'll guard myself, and you protect yourself. And so the Buddha tells this little story, and the Buddha basically kind of praises the apprentice. He said, that's the way it should be. In protecting oneself, we protect others. In protecting others, we protect ourselves. It seems like he's approving of the second one, that we should guard ourselves, and in guarding ourselves, we protect others. But then in his little saying that follows that, he says, protecting others, protecting self, we protect others. Protecting others, we protect ourselves. Suggesting that it goes maybe in both directions. We can do all of it simultaneously. And then he says, how do we protect ourselves? How do we protect others by protecting ourselves? He says, by practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, by practicing the basic mindfulness practice. And then he says, how do we protect others by protecting ourselves? How do we protect ourselves by protecting others? And he says, through the practice of patience, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and compassion. So the first is to practice mindfulness for oneself, to practice the basic practice. That's protecting oneself. And how does that protect others? It protects others because then we're not going to, if we really know ourselves well and understand our own motivations and have purified ourselves to some degree, then our inappropriate behavior is not going to be spilling over to others. There's lots of examples in the world of people who are involved in lots of good social causes who are completely blind to their own greed and hate and anger and all that, and created just havoc around them. In the 60s, in the civil rights movements, and in the lots of different, you know, anti-war movements, there were some examples of this, of people who, and I know people who left those movements because they were just, you know, there was too much conflict, there was too much anger and hate within those communities at times. So doing mindfulness, practicing mindfulness for ourselves, we certainly protect others from ourselves, which is certainly valuable to do. Protecting others, we protect ourselves. And through our feelings of compassion and equanimity, compassion, loving kindness, and joy in others, which are three of the four characteristics of love in Buddhism, and in practice of patience, then we're not going to create the conditions where other people are going to tend towards causing harm to ourselves. So that's not the same as being involved actively in helping other people, but it points to this idea that maybe these two don't have to be kept, self and other should be kept so separate. They can be somehow reconciled. For me, the primary place to reconcile these two is in through the framework of the Four Noble Truths, which hopefully you all know about. It's the basic teachings of the Buddha, central teaching of the Buddha. They are that how they're worded is significant, what I'm about to say. It basically says suffering exists, there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a path to the end of suffering. And why this is significant here is that there's no pronouns connected to this formula. It doesn't say, you know, you are suffering, you have suffering, or others have suffering. It just says suffering exists. And then there's a duty that the Buddha said that's, or a task that each person has in regard to each of the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth, suffering is to be understood. The cause of suffering is to be abandoned. And the cessation of suffering is to be realized. And the path, Eightfold Path, is to be cultivated. Suffering is to be understood. Since there are no pronouns in this description, I interpret this to mean that Buddhists are to be interested in suffering wherever they encounter it, without any distinction between self and other. Not that we abandon all distinctions of self and others, but wherever we happen to encounter suffering, that's where our practice should, you know, reside. And there are times when the suffering is met in yourself. Take it seriously and practice with that. And there's and sometimes you're going to encounter the suffering in the world around you. And take that equally serious. Both of them are of equal value. In Buddhism, at least, it's very explicitly said that you're not supposed to consider yourself better or worse than others. It isn't supposed to say that, you know, I don't count and others count more than me. Or the opposite, you know, that others don't count but I count more and with my well-being. But that all are equal. There's a famous koan, that's the wrong word, but kind of a test that is administered to people who do a lot of loving-kindness meditation. After the meditation, loving-kindness is very well developed. And the test is, if you have in front of you four people, yourself, some cherished person, maybe a family member, someone who you love, a neutral person, and an enemy. So those are four people you imagine in front of you. And a robber comes along, or, you know, murderer comes along, and says, okay, you have to choose which of those four I'm going to kill. And then the question is, who would you volunteer? And some people would rush and say, well, me, you know, take me, and I just save my friends. And some people would say, well, you know, the enemy, you know. Or, you know, various things people might say. And it turns out the right answer is that you're unable to make that distinction. That one person is more warrants that being killed than the other. So it's not a very satisfying puzzle in some ways. But it points to this idea that we're not supposed to make a distinction between self or others. One is more important than the other. And so we encounter suffering wherever we see it, and we take it seriously. And there we should, you know, that's where I kind of like to see the reconciliation. And I think the sense that I had that at some point in my practice that the practice didn't make any sense if it didn't include other people, wasn't for the sake of others, came out of this sensitivity. When a very strong boundary between self and other begins to dissolve, the kind of boundary that leaves us insensitive to the world around us. And I never felt that then the point was to only focus on others, but others became then included within, the needs of others included within the scope of practice and the motivation that I had for myself. The last thing I'll say is that I believe, you know, it's my opinion, that the question, that I believe there's a spectrum that we will find ourselves on. And that spectrum, on one end of the spectrum, is complete engagement with social action, completely kind of forgetting focus on oneself and just involved in one, dedicating one's practice in life to being of service to others, helping in all kinds of ways. And the other end of the spectrum is having no regard to the needs of others at all and completely absorbed in one's own practice and own liberation. And in between that is a spectrum. where there's a different percentages or combinations of those two. In the middle is 50% of each. And, you know, three quarters of the way, it's, you know, three quarters, you know, the motivation is towards others, and a quarter of it is just for oneself. So there's a kind of spectrum. And I think different people, and different people at different times in their lives, will find themselves at different points in that, along that spectrum. And it has something to do with, you know, phases of life, phases of practice. And it has something to do also with dispositions, the kind of personal dispositions, kind of predilections, something like that, and predilections that we have. And it also has something to do with life experience. It's been pointed out by some people, I don't know how accurate it is, but that some of the great religious leaders, founders, great religious figures of humankind, like the Buddha, lost a parent at an early age. So the Buddha's mother died when he was 7 days old. The great Zen master Dogen's mother died when he was six or seven. And there's that somehow that one's life experience of suffering, the degree to which one suffers personally, has a lot to do with where people put themselves on the spectrum. Some people, for whatever reason, have horrendous suffering they're trying to cope with. There was one retreat I taught recently. Not that one kind of suffering is more horrendous than others. I don't want to say that with, you know, giving this example. But there was one retreat. Being a meditation teacher on retreat is like, you know, often, you know, it's like hearing the repertoire of horrible things that happen to human beings, you know. It's a lot of people come to practice, come because of suffering. And some of it is very dramatic. And I remember there's one woman who came, and she had grown up in Iran. And a number of her family had been killed by the Shah. And she was jailed and tortured in many ways, and had both her knees broken, and then sent home with broken knees. And to this day, you know, some 30, 40 years later, she you know, has trouble walking. And then once the revolution, 79, happened in Iran, she was equally, her and her family was equally, had no place in there, and so finally she was able to escape. But, you know, there's all kinds, so depending on people's suffering, they'll put themselves at different points in the spectrum. Some people have no choice because their suffering is so great, but they somehow come to terms with their own suffering. Some people's personal suffering is so great, is of such a nature, that rather than focusing on their own suffering to be free, their freedom will come through service to others, maybe because seeing how, maybe in helping others, they help themselves, because seeing how other people are often in the same boat, and helping other people who've gone through the same difficulty and making a difference for them is healing for ourselves. There's so many factors that come into play about where anyone fits on the spectrum. So my sense is that we have to be very appreciative of that spectrum and be very careful not to come down with some policy or some narrow view that it's at only one place in the spectrum is the place to be, and which Buddhists do. I mean, some Buddhists will very clearly take stands. You know, only service to others, only if you're practicing for the well-being of others, are you really a Buddhist? And other people will say, you know, forget that. You know, the only thing that really counts, the only thing that really makes a difference is if you can get off the wheel of samsara yourself. So that's my opinion, is rather than having a particular opinion about where people fit on the spectrum, I think it's important that we hold the whole spectrum as something that we respect and support and appreciate each other for wherever any individual fits on the spectrum, and sensitive to the fact that it might be a particular phase in their life. And later, you know, whatever phase you're in, you might end up in the same phase they're in right now. We never know how things change. So those are my thoughts about that. I hope that was useful and interesting. I have no idea. I had a little bit of sense about 10 minutes ago that I was maybe tiring you, going on and on. Somehow a wave of something went through the room, I thought. So that's the way it goes, if that happened. do you want to, probably a little bit at time to stop now. So if someone wants to leave, you're more than welcome to leave. It'd be nice if you did a little bit quietly, because I'd like to take a few comments or questions from you, because this is a very important topic. And I don't want to be the one who has the last word. Yes?
I think it's also useful to keep in mind that often the people who are making that criticism of our interest in Buddhism, the self-absorption and so forth, often they're spending as much time watching TV as we are. as an alternative to watching television, I think
Well, the other thing that's interesting is if you did stamp collecting, if you told them you spent just as much time stamp collecting, they wouldn't have the same criticism. There's something because it's an expectation that religion has to be of social service, and therefore if you're not doing that, then it's selfish. But stamp collecting is not selfish; it's not just charged. And part of this phenomena, I meant to say, of social engagement. Is the expectation that it's interesting, and I don't want to say this with an opinion, right? So don't infer anything from what I'm about to say about my opinion. But there's maybe also sometimes people involved in a religion want to be involved in social work, social extension, helping others, and they expect it has to happen through their religion, religious congregation or whatever. And it's fine to have the two happen separately. There's nothing wrong with, you know, practicing certain religion Sunday morning and having it completely just self-contained in some ways, and then Sunday afternoon going down and helping Habitat for Humanities, doing something else. We don't have to, it's okay to have, it's maybe okay to have these things somewhat compartmentalized too. A particular congregation or group doesn't have to hold everything, be the entire package of our humanity within it. Yes?
And another criticism related to somewhat different that Buddhism practices acceptance and non-grasping, all that, and people in social action, the world is a broken place and we must get up. Could you speak on that dichotomy? Some of it.
You want me to speak about it? I think you've inferred enough. Don't you think? You kind of made the point very well. I don't think that. I think Buddhists are not meant. It's very naive to interpret acceptance as being everything. Everything's just fine, man. Everything's perfect, just the way it is. And nothing needs to be done. It's a very naive idea of acceptance. Acceptance, my understanding of acceptance in Buddhist practice is maybe better captured by the word allowance, allowing. That we allow the world to be as it is. We allow the experience of the world to reside in our minds and our hearts without any contraction towards it. So it's not, we might still be involved in changing something. But we're not contracted. We're not resisting in our mind. Our awareness, the doors of our eyes, are completely open and ready to allow it in awareness. The inner life doesn't contract and resist or hate or have greed connected to it. What we do in our actions can be very different. And yes?
Just a comment. Many years ago, I sat some time with the International Buddhist Meditation Center, which is a Vietnamese Zen center, and that was headed by Thich Thich Nhat Hanh, who passed away in 1980. But the abbess was telling me that in Vietnamese Buddhism, Vietnamese Zen Buddhism, they have like the middle way on that. They do both. And that many people remember from the 60s with the monks who lit themselves on fire, and Thich Nhat Hanh. And even in the International Buddhist Meditation Center, he set up a meditation center where he did ordain monks and nuns, and they did all practice together. But one Ango period was when a lot of refugees were coming in from Vietnam, because this Ango period, we're not going to sit, we're going to help refugees. down at Camp Pendleton, as they seem to balance the two, and it's really infused in the whole Vietnamese culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
I think one of the advantages of where we are anyway is there's a very rich amount of not-for-profit organizations who have built up a lot of skill and understanding about specific issues. And so if we try to do too much within the Sangha, like let's say mental illness, you could deal with a mental illness organization and people really know what needs to be done in that area, or homelessness or whatever. So that's an advantage to having them be both. So you can serve there.
Right, right. Yes, Helen.
Maybe not seem very connected, but a story that occurred to me while we were talking was the time that I was once rescued by a lifeguard when I didn't need to be or didn't want to be. And the notion that somehow you have to be at a place where you understand before you can truly serve is what came to me from that experience. That person thought they were helping, but I didn't think they were helping.
It's a very good example, but it does occur to me that I would prefer my lifeguards to err in that direction. Yes.
When we're done with questions, can I make an announcement about the chapter?
Oh, yes, please. Why don't you do it now?
We're in the process of setting up an East Bay Buddhist Peace Fellowship chapter.
East Bay?
West Bay. I'm on the West Bay. and so basically for the peninsula down to San Jose. And there's two sanghas that are involved, our sangha and the Community for Mindful Living, which is based on Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings, very, very compatible with our practice. But we're also looking to engage other sanghas and other Buddhist traditions in this process. And it's really in its forming stages, and Gil's been very supportive in terms of encouraging us. And we have a couple things coming up. One is there is some discussion about taking a group to Habitat for Humanity for one day and working. And Bert, you want to raise your hand? Can answer any questions about that if you're interested in helping with that. We're trying to plan some simple activities that we can do that would be like a one-time to kind of bring the group together and develop a critical mass of people that are interested in being socially engaged with their Buddhist practice. That's one of them. And we're also looking at some options for a combination of sitting and dialogue that would go with this, that would incorporate it into our practice, and we're looking at doing something on that in January. And, there's a lot of seeds right now, and so we'll have to see what sprouts. But if you're interested, we do have a list, an e-list, that if you have email, that you can stay in touch with us, and you can just give me your email address, and I'd be glad to stick you on that. Or you can ask me or Bert, or I see Ash in the back. Can you raise your hand? during the potluck, if you're interested in being involved.
I read in the paper today about George Bush's efforts to create more, I guess, volunteerism and social responsibility among citizens. And also we know about his religious initiatives. They have religious groups be more involved in public service. And, you know, it comes out of this social gospel kind of partly efforts. And we have various opinions about it, what he's doing. But one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, America is a very religious culture. And there is a very strong the established religions of the land have a very big influence on the public dialogue and public values and public views of what's going on in America. And if we accept that that's the case, then I think one of the ways that I hope Buddhism develops in America is that because of that situation, that Buddhism does develop to be strong enough force in the society that it can participate in the public dialogue. Because I would rather not have the current speakers have a monopoly on the public dialogue of what goes on. So, for example, a very simple thing. The people who want to teach creationism in the school, which I think is, you know, absurd. But if they're going to start, you know, get the upper hand someplace, then I would like to come along and say, well, Buddhists have their own creationism story. And to have, we have a strong enough voice that we get their attention, and so then they back down. You know, they don't want the Buddhist one. They wanted their own, but if they're going to have, you know, freedom of religion, then they have to include ours. I'm ready to tell them ours. So I think it'd be very nice, I think, when American Buddhism becomes established well enough, it can be participant in the public dialogue and by both our actions and our thoughts. So thank you all very much, and I'll see you in a few weeks.